The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Ezekiel Horrell, a longtime employee with the library, and I am honored to introduce Malcolm Jenkins. One of pro football's all-time defensive greats, Jenkins won Super Bowls with the Philadelphia Eagles. Go Birds. No doubt. And the New Orleans Saints, my hometown. He also appeared in 3 Pro Bowls. He won the prestigious Jim Thorpe Award as a senior at The Ohio State University before entering the NFL as a first-round draft pick, where he played for an impressive 13 seasons. Since retiring, Jenkins has become a racial justice advocate and entrepreneur whose business ventures include Listen Up Media conglomerate and his own media company called Malcolm Inc. In addition, he has also had various philanthropic organizations, the Malcolm Jenkins Foundations, which assists young people in underserved communities. A memoir about his life on the playing field, advocating for Black Americans, and the highs and lows of his personal life, What Winners Won't Tell You, is a meditation on what it means to find balance and that thin space between victory and defeat. Tonight, Jenkins will be in conversation with Michael Eric Dyson, a frequent guest of the library right here, and the author of many best-selling books, including Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America, What Truth Sounds Like, and The Black Presidency. An MSNBC political analyst and a professor at Vanderbilt University, his many honors include an American Book Award and 2 NAACP Image Awards. Now, please, together, let's welcome Malcolm Jenkins and Michael Eric Dyson.
Wow, good to see y'all. Everybody good?
Yes.
What a wonderful opportunity it is to be here tonight to engage in some serious reflection, dialogue, and conversation with one of the greatest athletes this nation has ever seen. And not just an athlete, but a philanthropist, an entrepreneur, a humanitarian, a social justice advocate, right? And a great brother. His very good-looking parents are here tonight. Stand up, please. I want them to stand up.
So yeah.
They've been passing as his parents. I think they're his brother and sister. So we're going to get started, but I got to tell Malcolm, I didn't even tell him this. I got 3 voicemails. It's only going to take a couple minutes, don't worry. It's 3 voicemails that I received that I want to play tonight to start us off.
All right.
If we can do that, okay? So y'all just play along, and we're going to play these voicemails, and we'll get started after that. I'll see what's on them. I didn't get a chance to listen to them. All right? So here we go. Start it up. What?
Certainly an egregious action. He's very clearly trying his best to look like you. So let me know if there's anything that I can do, but I certainly hope that you get this figured out. Okay?
Thanks.
Miss you. Hope you're doing amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, keep me updated.
I didn't know
all
that.
Right. Goodbye.
All right. We got a couple more.
Dr. Dyson, it's your friend Skip Bayless. Just had a quick note for you. Got an advanced copy of the Malcolm Jenkins book. Looks terrific. Can't wait to read it. I'm sure he, of all people, would have a whole lot to say. But just a quick heads up. I don't really know how to say this, but I think they've used your body on the No big deal to me, if it's no big deal to you, but it just sounds like Malcolm and his publisher are perpetrating a little bit of a hoax here.
Oh.
I didn't know if you knew about this. Just wanted to give you a heads up.
Very kind of them to call me.
Maybe you know, maybe you don't.
One more.
Stop, 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 man. I mean, you can't just be putting... I know you got a fly book coming out, man. You're 2-time Super Bowl champion, 13-year NFL veteran. I mean, we miss you already. You've been gone for a little bit. We miss you. We get all of that. But you ain't got to remind us who you are by stealing and photoshopping an image of Dr. Dyson's body, man.
Oh, I didn't know what they were saying. I had never noticed. There is a strong resemblance.
I didn't know he was going to catch on to my secret, man.
I mean, you could have called me. I would have given you permission, $25,000.
I forgot to give him the photo credit. That's a big, big violation.
You see this beautiful man on the cover. More beautiful inside. More beautiful in his heart and mind. And I want to talk about, in three separate sections tonight, right? I want to talk about the professional. I want to speak about the political. And then we want to talk about the personal, right? You've all gotten a book when you gain entrance. It's a riveting book. And I want to speak, first of all, Brother Malcolm, about the construction of the book, because you are one of the most notoriously well-prepared athletes of any sports, but certainly within football. Talk to us about what I call the jump cutting, right? You start in one place speaking about, you know, your personal life, then you jump to what happened in your childhood, then you're right there at the game. And it's not misleading at all. It's rather much like watching a movie or being brought into the midst of the battle in a very effective way. Talk to us about the choice to do that in this memoir.
I think one of the things I've been into lately is storytelling, right? And so when I started to think of my own story, what I wanted to put in this book, you know, I went back and went through these things. And what athletes, you know, any good story has a roller coaster of emotions, right? It takes you on a journey, some highs, some lows, some doubt, some triumph. And I realized that as an athlete, my entire life, I've been trained to give people the feeling of excitement. Like a big hit will make 100,000 people stand on their feet, to win a game that can change a city, right? Like I know very well how to give that to people. But when you begin to try to write that down, it's not a good story, right? Like it's too much triumph. And the good thing about, or one thing about athletes is our stories usually end after the game is over. That's kind of where you see us, is on Sundays, but you don't see Monday through Saturday. And so, okay, I started to look at my story different. Like, okay, I have to include the 360-degree version of who I am. And that led me to wanting to create an experience. I wanted it to feel visual. So you'll see it jump from, I know it dropped today, so most of you have not read it, so I'm not going to spoil it for you. But it jumps back and forth. It's not a linear story, right? I didn't want to write an autobiography. I wanted to write a narrative. And so it is a collection of short stories throughout my life that goes back and forth, similar to the way a football game does. You'll feel that fast pace. You'll see the sudden changes in life, the way I had to react to things, the places, the plays I may have given up, the failures I've had, and then the triumphs. And you realize that winning is not something that you arrive at. It's something that you continually do. You don't win after the game. The game is over. You win because of the way you play life, the way that you go about it. And you really see me navigate that throughout this book. And hopefully, you know, at the end, I wanted to tell a good story. And that's how I put the book together.
Mm-hmm. That's a great story. Beautifully written, eloquent, lucid, and honest. I mean, sticking with the professional, you're obviously one of the most gifted athletes of your generation as a DB and a safety. And you talk openly and honestly about wanting to be a nickel because a dime was not available. look, I work on these jokes. I mean, yeah, I better hear some laughter out here. But no, I mean, I want you to explain to us, right, what the position is, because when I read this book, like, it's some of the clearest explanation for the layperson about what it is. You're making defense sexy, not simply by your Michael Eric Dyson body. but I mean, you're making it sexy in the sense that offense is the one. It's the quarterback. He's throwing the ball. Running back. He's running. Right? The wide receiver. You're giving us detailed explanation in a very lucid fashion about disguising coverages, trying to trick Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and the like. Talk to us about the importance of that position in sport and why you were so gung-ho of trying to master the nickel.
Yeah, one of the things that I always hated kind of about the narrative of athletes is that dumb jock kind of narrative, because I've always found the game of football to be a very cerebral game. But we only usually talk about the quarterbacks as the ones who have, you know, the smarts or the brains in the game. So I wanted to make sure that my story when I start talking about football was going to be one of a cerebral approach to the game, not about the rah-rah and acrobatic things, but more the mentality, because that's really what's going to translate to somebody who's not an athlete, who doesn't care about sports. They're going to want to know, well, you know, how did you navigate this situation? What were the stakes? And one of the books that I've read, one of the memoirs I read that really kind of gave me the language for it was Andre Agassi's Open. He talks about tennis, and I was not a big tennis fan, didn't know the rules of tennis, but by the end of his memoir, I understood it, and he brought you into such details that you thought you were him. It wasn't about kind of the voyeuristic view of the match, because, you know, like football, I can't talk about a Super Bowl that everybody's already watched probably 10 times. It's like, how do I retell these stories in a way that you haven't experienced before? And so I bring you into my helmet, and that's everything from the split second decisions that I have to make, the understanding, you know, how to play off of different players, or seeing things that you've already prepared for in a game, and how they transition with you over time. One of my favorite, you know, parts of the book, I even talk about knowing, like, how the game is really, life sometimes is not that hard, right? Just take the layups that it gives you. It's a chapter called Tips and Overthrows. Mm-hmm. And do y'all remember we had DeMarco Murray and Miles Austin on the team back in the Chip Kelly days? Got rid of our favorite running back and got a Dallas Cowboy to come replace him. But that year we were going to play the Cowboys, and they gave us Miles Austin and DeMarco, they give us the list of all of the Cowboys' signals, plays, everything. And so they literally hold whole meetings. And so I'm taking the ones that I could use. But I'm thinking, and, you know, I get to the game and there's no way that they're going to use these same signals. They know we got their star running back. There's no way. And lo and behold, the first quarter, Tony Romo's giving all the signals, doing all the ones. And he pulls up and does one that I recognize. It's the discount double check. Right. That means that, okay, the tight end that I'm covering is going to do this flat, and they're going to throw the screen. It's 100% of the time. He did the discount double check, and I kind of look around it like everybody saw it okay. And the ball snapped, and I too eagerly jump to, I'm like, he's about to throw it right to me. And he sees me, and he pumps. In his hesitation, Jordan Hicks, the linebacker, hits him, falls, and he breaks his collarbone. And so when you're like, the chain reactions to just knowing something like that, just a small bit of information, how it impacts the entire game, that's kind of how I like to talk about football. And so you'll see those kind of moments in this book where it's not really about, you know, the play in and of itself. It's about those minute details that make the difference. And the hard part that was different than Andre Agassi's book is tennis is one-on-one, right? You're really only describing yourself, but football is a team sport where you're aware of everyone at all times, the offense, that's your opponent, but also your teammates, the sideline. You're somewhat aware of the vibrations of the fans. And that's really how life is, right? You're walking through carrying this responsibility for many people, whether it's your family, your community, your kids. You're aware of what's happening in the world around you. We all experience that. And I try to write it from that narrative.
Mm-hmm. It's very effective. And I must say, refreshingly and also remarkably honest, right? Because you talk about how with one particular team that they put out the statistics of the guy that they chose over you, and you talk about how you failed to meet the measure of his excellence at every turn, but then it drove you to try to master your game. You didn't take it as bitterness. You didn't take it as personal. Think about Jordan, and yeah. I took it personal. but you used it to fuel your own greatness. And nobody who's ever watched you play, and I have on many an occasion, as you know, how dominant, how aggressive you are. I mean, you're such a nice guy. You talk to you come to church, hey, how you doing? I was like, he's committing mayhem out here. I mean, they should arrest this guy. It's pretty a violent sport to begin with. But talk to us about your ability to self-correct as a critical agent of your own excellence, that it drove you and fueled you by acknowledging what you didn't do. You know, Michael Jordan said, I did so well because I failed so much. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about why it was important in this book to share your failures as well as your successes.
Yeah, I think one of the things my dad always said to me, and I never used to listen to it as a kid, but it somehow finds itself in this narrative, is that you don't know what you don't know. Right, and that can be meant a lot of ways, but the way I took it was that you always have to have enough humility to believe that you may be wrong, or there's some things out there that you don't know. There's an angle that you haven't seen, and that forces you to always be curious. And so for me, the moment you reference is at one point in the league, I got rated the worst safety in the NFL. Wow. This was before my time in Philly, right?
right.
And, and then the very next year, I think I was the second to last safety in the league. And then I got kicked out of New Orleans. And I had to, really interrogate myself to where I don't need to believe what people are saying to me, because I know what's within me, but at the same time, I have to have enough humility to believe that there is something true about this that I have to figure out. And if I figure that out, then that's what the problem is. And a lot of people struggle with facing themselves for what they are. There's an analogy, I got my best friend Jeff here. We play a lot of video games. And what we like to do is we'll turn on, like a fighting game, and we'll select a character at random. And if you know anything about video games, characters, the buttons are kind of the same, but their moves are all different. And the characters have different qualities. Some are really good at kicking, some are balanced, some are big and slow, some are quick and fast. And you realize that you cannot use the same technique. It's not a one size fits all. But that's how we try to kind of go through life. We see other people, that we want to be like, or we see things that we want to have, and we try to fit ourselves into this box, but your avatar does not do that. You're trying to be a kicking thing when you really are not. And so the one thing I had to figure out was, okay, if these are all my weaknesses, then what are my strengths? And then how do I protect my weaknesses and play to my strengths? And then I'll continuously build on those things I'm strong at, and I'll work on the things that I'm weak at. And what started to happen was I developed myself and my game into something that was crazy. It was what I could believe, right? What I knew I had in me. But I had to first humble myself enough to say, okay, maybe there's some truth here, and let's dig. Let's be curious about it. And that's really one of the things that I think was key to my turnaround is just the ability to be not only curious about the world, but curious about ourselves. What is it that I do best? And let me lean into that. And that's one thing I hope that people, are inspired to kind of do in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me build on that, because it's deep enough to do that in private. It's deep enough to do that one-on-one. You know, as a professor, we have a famous law professor here, Professor Stacey Hawkins. And can you imagine somebody coming to you after, Professor Hawkins, part of the lecture was great, but the other part lacked the kind of, insight that it should occur. Why did you make that choice? Like, can you imagine, right? They're literally asking you, after a game, when you're the height of emotion, first of all, why you did what you did, but to assess you in public and to hold you to account, that's a whole nother level. People experience that a little bit on Facebook and social media, but athletics have been doing that for decades. Mm-hmm. What does that feel like to be, you talk in the book about Deion Sanders,
yeah,
your idol,
yeah,
but he's crapping on you at a certain level, right? I mean, you can get him back now.
I can't. He's killing it. Deion's. I'm more proud of Deion now as a coach than I actually was as a player.
Yes.
He's doing great things.
Right. But talk. He is. Let's give him a. He is. And he's making money on them sunglasses.
For sure. He's always about his business.
Must be the money. Okay. So, but here's the thing. But to be held to account in public, I just want to underscore that, right? Where the world is hearing you, good, the bad, the ugly, the faults, the virtues, and the like. Talk to us about what it means to be held to an account in public by a standard that is evoked by people who judge you, and how that is different from a kind of private consideration of what your failures are, and what that does to kind of spur you on.
Yeah, I've always been one to respond better to adversity than to praise. So sometimes I'll create, chaos just to have something to go against, right? So for me, it's always fear. And it's the first chapter of the book. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people who, I wasn't born this way, but I talk about how my grandmother makes me face a fear that I have and won't let me in the house until I do. Right. And that turned me into a person who always leans into the things I'm afraid of. Even retirement, I got to the point where I was like, hey, I have the life I want. My family's good. My family's safe. I'm healthy. My brain is healthy. My body feels good. I think I've had enough. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that really was like holding on to me once I evaluated it was I was afraid to step into what the unknown was. And that's being a football, like outside of the game. Who am I outside of football? And we all say, oh, I'm more than an athlete. And yes, that sounds great in a slogan, but when you actually take your pads off and you are no longer, in the stadium, you're no longer in the process. I was like, I didn't even eat lunch for like 2 months because I don't have a schedule to tell me when to eat lunch. That's how programmed you are. Mm. This is who you are. Since the age of 7, I was playing football. So to think about letting go of that is scary. Mm. But when I realized that was the only anchor, then I had to lean into it. That's when retirement almost became inevitable. Everybody in my team, you'll see, was shocked by my retirement because it wasn't that my body couldn't do it. It wasn't that the money wasn't good. It wasn't, that I didn't love the game. It was just I was no longer afraid of the game. Mm. And I had to lean into that in which I was afraid of. And that was writing this book. And so it definitely was something that was vulnerable. As an athlete, you look for, like, what is that replacement of the game, that nerve you get right before you step out into the stadium? Dropping this book gave me that feeling. This is kind of that next, and this is a pun, but next chapter.
Before we leave the profession on the athletic, as a defensive player, I mean, you're marked in many ways, but you have the distinction of being the only one to beat both Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. What the hell did he mean by Omaha? I just want to know, like, Omaha! It's, Omaha! Right.
It means nothing at all.
Yeah, right. He's trying to throw you off, right?
Yeah, it's just distracting. Then once the fans start getting onto it, now he's got Omaha Productions, and there's a whole business now.
But you break that down in the book beautifully. You talk about yellow. You talk about all the things. Look, you know whether this is serious. We're trying to psych them out. They're trying to psych us out. He's at the... But you did talk about how Peyton Manning is at the line of scrimmage, like changing the game right there. That's a level of genius.
I learned a lot from a little. You'll see that in the game. I'm not somebody who asks for a lot of help, but if I hear something, I'm going to evaluate it all the way. So I would spend time talking with Drew Brees and just picking his brain in practice about, hey, what do you see? What do you look at? And that came to bite me in the butt when I became his opponent, and I knew that yellow 80 doesn't mean anything at all. It means don't snap the ball. When he's ready for the ball, he'll say ready, ready. Or Drew Brees will not snap the ball until he licks his hand 3 times,
right,
which post-COVID is disgusting. But in a football game, you know, it's like that minute of a thing. And so I learned a lot, you know, from that, and I try to bring the reader into that kind of knowledge, like that nuance of the game, where it's less about the plays and this person ran a slant, but it's more about the feel of the game. You know, how can I make you feel like a player who's in the zone or in the flow? The later I got in my career, the more I found myself in that, just by being present. I remember my teammate, Roman Harper, I was young, and I talk about him in the book. Mm-hmm. He once told me, he read a run play. He was a strong safety, and he used to play the run so well. And I'm like, how do you know the difference between a run and a pass? Like, what are you looking at? He was like, I don't know. It's a feel. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, the run sounds different. I'm like, sounds different? What are you talking about? And he's like, it's just a feel. And it wasn't until like year 7 or 8 that I understood what he meant. He was playing football with not just his eyes, and he's playing football with all of his senses, right? So it's like, what does it feel like in a run? That's something I never considered. What a run sounds like versus a pass were things I never really considered. And so you start to just experience what you are doing more deeply. You understand it to your core at that point. And that's what that flow is where you're so present in the moment that the crowd is just a vibration. Like, your opponent is really a pawn because you've seen this already. You know what this is. You know what this feels like. You play with all of your senses. You know, that's a hard feeling to replicate, but I try to write that in this. Mm-hmm. I try to at least, you know, give you that feel as I write.
Well, it's remarkable. I mean, I'm a football fan. You know, our friend Dr. James Peterson over here, an Eagles fan. I'm in Tennessee now with the Titans. Look at the silence of these Eagles people. Look at
so enthused.
Very rude. I mean, but when you think about the stances you took as we transition to the political, you took some stands, but you didn't just take public stands. You did research. You did background analysis. You went and spoke to Commissioner Ross, right, of the police department. Why is it important for a famous athlete like you, with an extraordinary platform that people love because you're apolitical, because they don't really know what you think, the risk that you took to publicly state your identification with black people after you talk in the book about I'm not giving too much away here. You talk in the book about Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. I mean, that moved a lot of us. That's why I wrote my book, Tears We Cannot Stop. I just finished my book on Obama, but I had to write that because of that. And that inspired you to really get involved and talk about, these are my people. Talk to us about the difficult negotiation as a famous athlete, as a famous black athlete who identifies with his community and makes that a priority.
Yeah, there was really no negotiation. I mean, for me, a lesson that I got really early from my dad was, you know, he'd say, when we got old enough, he'd make us go outside and clean up trash, any trash that was in front of the house. So we'd pause the video game, go outside, clean the trash, go back, play the video game. He'll come back in, "You're not done yet." I'm like, "What do you mean we're not done yet? We clean the whole house." He's like, he would make us clean 2 houses that way and 2 houses that way. And this idea that you're responsible for your home, right? Responsible for your community. Mm-hmm. And one of the things for me, everywhere that I played, I considered home. And so you know, when it comes to fighting for your people or seeing those things, it was just like, okay, I had enough. Like, this is too much. What can I do? How do I take inventory of the things I have at my own disposal to do something? I'm like, okay, I don't really know what that looks like. And that's where kind of that you don't know what you don't know thing starts, right? Where I start analyzing it, and let's work our way backwards. Okay, there's one thing that athletes can do. We can bring people together, right? People from all races, we do that every weekend. Cool. How do I get the community who needs to be heard, you know, in front of the people who make the decisions? That's where we fit in as athletes. And we started with just a meeting with some players, some community members, and the former Commissioner Ross. And then we realized, okay, well, this is not the only solution. And we just keep pulling on that thread all the way until, you know, we realize we create an organization of athletes now that grew from just 12 to a dozen other professional sports that are now activating in their cities, doing work, everything from writing op-eds to doing community forums to full-on lobbying. Those type of things had never been accomplished before, never been built. It was something I never even thought I could do, but it just started with a responsibility, a sense of responsibility for my home, and the curiosity to try to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, your sport is notoriously conservative.
Yeah.
You know, with the, they don't call them owners anymore, what do they call them? Governors. Right? Governor, I think about the, you know, British pronunciation there, but here you are. Clearly, I watched that movie myself, and you didn't see it. But as a very conservative group, they're not the NBA.
No.
The NBA has its problems too. Trust, we saw the racist owners, governors. But your sport is notoriously conservative. So it's not that I'm going to push back on you. Your own particular valor and courage, notwithstanding, you talk about truth, courage, and love, mm-hmm. right? But it does take, I mean, Jerry Jones. Now, thing is, I pay these Negroes, and I want them to act like that I pay them. And I'm not going to hire. If you go out there, I'm going to fire every one of you. I mean, yeah. Dude, right? I mean, really. So they don't clearly know Jerry Jones because I was killing that accent right there.
Yeah.
God damn, y'all don't even know. I want an Oscar for that because. But here's the point. There was intimidation. You got the President of the United States of America. I just want to paint the picture for people to see what you were speaking into.
Yeah.
The President of the United States of America, well, the former president, now still making news. What the hell is going on with Republicans by kicking out this Speaker of the House? But I just want to say that because I'm sure you've seen that.
You've been waiting to talk about this all day.
Yeah, yeah. Them damn Republicans. The crackerocracy has gone crazy. Anyway. I'm talking about the right-wing tyrannical assertion of white supremacy as the premise of existence in America. That's all I'm talking about. But the point is, back to your book, but you are speaking out when a president is saying, arrest them MFs and mugs and these bums and sons of bitches, that's what he called them. And you are quietly, you know, holding your fist up, holding up a sign. I was like, man, he's watching Spike Lee. He's watching Spike Lee, right? He's watching Spike Lee.
Yeah.
You made incredibly politically charged gestures in a very conservative sport, and you didn't back down. It's one thing for Russell Wilson to go to visit babies that Sean Payton, your former coach, doesn't want him to do, and Sean crapped on the coach before him, but how about that 70 hung on you by the... All right, yeah, I'm sorry. I just want to get a little revenge here.
Yeah.
But so the point is, it's one thing when he goes to the hospital. You build a hospital and you kiss babies. Social service is deemed as effective and acceptable. Social justice, not so much. And there's a tremendous difference. Why is it that you were able? What did you pull on to make you able to withstand that brutal opposition and to articulate viewpoints and values that supported your people?
A group. It wasn't just me. The first thing we did when Kaepernick knelt was, my first thought was, oh, we gotta start a group chat. Like, we gotta get behind this. And the first thing I did was, one, surround myself with other guys who were like me, okay? And the good thing I knew about myself is that I had enough leverage as a player you know, and I knew it was important then to, okay, I got to make sure that I perform, because the first thing people want to see is, will your performance go down? Okay, so as long as I continue that, contractually, I was in a good place. I had just got a new deal.
Right.
So, you know, you weren't going to cut me. so, you know, I had a little bit of protection there. And then with that protection, you feel a responsibility. And when you attach that to guys who were in that same position around the league, the Devin McCourties of the league, you know, you know, you had the 49ers, you had the guys down in Miami, Michael Thomas and Kenny Stills, guys all over the league. It's like, okay, collectively, you know, you can't wipe us all out. That is clearly collusion, right? But we know that they can get you one at a time. So the idea is, okay, as a collective, let's start a group. When we start a group, we can, one, share our platforms. We can, if I can get some people together, imagine how many, you know, we can all get together. And then we realized that politically, you know, after going to D.C. and trying to, you know, talk to politicians, we realized that shit doesn't happen up there. So we came back to the drawing board and realized that, nah, most of the majority of our effectiveness and policies are on a local level. And we are heroes in our local markets. Okay, great. Let's create an organization that immobilizes players in their market where they can be most effective, where they can affect everything from community building all the way to policing. And so it very much for us was just like strategy. It's the same, we just applied the same, or I applied the same concepts that I knew in football. I was like, all right, I'm not going to try to tackle Marshawn Lynch by myself.
Right.
We gotta all figure out a way to get the corral this guy. And you know, for other guys. So when you talk about like, how do we stand up against those guys? It wasn't me by myself. It's Anquan Boldin, who I had to look at, you know, when he retired. And then my role was hard because I became the one who had to speak the most.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Anquan Boldin retired to do the work full time. Right. He joined it because his cousin was murdered by a cop. And mm-hmm. and he went to fight that and got justice for his cousin. He retired to do that work full time. Mm-hmm. I was still playing. And so, you know, I talk about in the book, when you get to that point, when you have your collective, you have your base to stand on, and now you can stand up, you better believe there's going to be resistance. And that's where poise comes in. And that's that critical moment in the game where everything's tense, it's on the line. You know, the crowd has the ability to, and right, to feel that tension and to crack in those circumstances, but the player has to be poised enough to block all of that out. Mm-hmm. And that's how we really, you know, should. That's really what leadership turns into. And so when you see me kind of stand up in these certain situations in the book as we negotiate with the Jerry Joneses of the world and the NFL, it's really that collective that I fell on. And honestly, it was a little bit of stupidity too, because, you know, now that it's the ignorant bliss, because now that I'm outside of the game, I'm like, wow, I'm trying to watch regular TV and it's football on four nights a week. And it's like you realize how much the world is, our country is like surrounded and engulfed in this game, how much mm-hmm. we balance our schedules to this sport. And I realized like, wow, we were up against that. Like, you don't really yeah. understand it, or to even realize that I was center stage of that same vehicle is kind of mind blowing now being on this side of it. But being in it, I think I leaned heavily on, you know, the guys that I was working with.
Mm-hmm. Typical humility. Typical humility, because he was a leader. He articulated values and visions and virtues that were critical that people surrounded as a result of what his speech made a way, right? And functioned as a clearinghouse for ideas that were critical, and others who were not as articulate and who were not as experienced in making these kinds of arguments.
But what I will say, and it's not humility, it's like I really understood my role. I was playing full-time football. I am not a politician.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm speaking on these things, I'm getting that information from a team of people, right, that are helping me do this research.
Right.
And I leaned heavily on the people who were doing that work. So Keir Bradford Gray is in the building. She's somebody who I met, was a chief public defender, and I was able to bring Roger Goodell and Jeffrey Lurie to her office to explain to them firsthand what's happening.
Right.
Right. And so it's not really even about the things that, so I'm in the meeting too, learning just like them. I'm taking mm-hmm. notes so that when I do get to my locker and I can speak on stories, and because statistics don't move anybody. even in sports, right? If I just throw a bunch of stats on the screen and roll it by, you're not gonna watch that. Mm. You wanna see Stephen A. Smith making up words and going crazy things, right? Like that's, we like stories, you know? And so, you know, that really became the role, is like, how do we, as athletes, mm-hmm. take this platform, elevate these voices, and, you know, and obviously that wasn't an easy thing to do at that time, but now sure. when you look at the landscape,
oh, it's changed.
And what we were able to open up, mm-hmm. now, you know, there's no resistance to athletes trying to speak their minds or trying to bring these community things to the forefront, and that's a beautiful thing. And we knew that that's the moment that we were at back at that time.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. Yeah. Well, it also makes you appreciate Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Althea Gibson, Wilma Rudolph, Jim Brown, mm-hmm. you know, Ernie Davis, mm-hmm. like at a time when it was even more crucial,
yeah.
and stood up. And they were full-time athletes as well. So I don't want to argue with you about your own book, but I mean, I just want to give you some more love and credit for what you're doing, man. We got a few minutes left. The personal. I'll blend this because, you know, you were in a prodigy on many levels, 13 years old. Okay, I was like, damn, what kind of program was I on? I was 18 when I made the transition into the opposite sex. Let's just say it that way. And you talk about, I'm just telling you what the man writing this book, okay? I was like, damn, I was a late bloomer, I guess. The hell? How tall were you back then? Anyway, I mean, but that ain't the thing. Okay, the thing that you did it, and then you go home and your mother's like, I've heard you've had unprotected sex. That's all she, like, that's it? And you were like, no, I was protected.
Man, you gonna ruin the book for the names, man. You ain't read the whole book yet.
They about to read that book right now. I'm selling your book, dog. Boy, when he was talking about one night when he was, no, okay. Yeah, I was like, very white of your family. Y'all were like, yes, I've had sex, but it was protected. Okay, what kind of condom did you use? I mean, like, what the hell? But you exposed it, right? You talk about that, you talk about your marriage and your divorce. You speak about your children. One thing I was wondering, your name Malcolm, your mm-hmm. brother's name Miles and Martin, is mm-hmm. that like Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Miles Davis?
Sure,
or
is
that right?
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? What's that? Beautiful. I thought that was the case, but I didn't want to assume it. Thank you for coming to confirm that for me. But so you know, you're the personal, right? You talk about your coaches, you talk about, of course, your father and your mother, your beloved grandmother and her relationship, and what he referred to, of course, when, you know, a lot of us growing up in the hood, oh, somebody whipped your ass, then you better get back out there,
yeah.
and fight it. And, you know, Hakeem.
Yeah.
But I ain't gonna tell you the story now. Hassan and Hakeem. You killed it, me, man. All right. It's a great movie. When the movie's made, I need to be in it.
I got you.
I'll be the narrator.
Right.
Young Malcolm at 13. But
you're wondering how I got here?
But you're honest about it, and it's a beautiful story. It's about black love, it's about black struggle. And let me ask you this question. One of the things you talk about quite openly. You know, I see you have your watch on tonight. Mm-hmm. You know, very nice watch. Right, and you said, you know, at all the years you were in the, you know, you hadn't bought any, you know, any luxurious jewelry in about 8 years, and you got the watch, and then somebody was basically saying, you know, you got a watch, but you can't bring your brothers to the Super Bowl. And I felt you, because so many of us, you know, there's a book called Black Picket Fences about the way in which the black middle class could generate more wealth if they were not helping so many in their own families. And Jay-Z recently got in, you know, it's all on the X, I guess now Twitter, where he was like, yeah, you know, that you make this money, you go home for Thanksgiving, and your cousin is in there like, yo, if you got $4,800, I could flip it. I could flip this into make a million. And Jay is like, but it really doesn't work like that. And so thank you for the appreciation for my Jay-Z voice. The hell is wrong with you people anyway? What are you, Ja Rule fans? I mean, Jay, what's going on? When the rim is in the system. Come on, man, I'm killing the Jay-Z voice. So, but that's a you're honest about that. And the demand on you, speak to us about the demand as a successful black person,
that doesn't walk into a room by yourself?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that happens when you go from collegiate sports to professional is you go from a world where you're dependent on everyone to then flipping everything to the world becomes dependent on you, and you're probably 21 years old, right? And there's, because now you are the, you know, even if you're not necessarily monetarily the golden ticket, it's you begin to live a life that you automatically want to take people with you. Like, you don't come alone. You know, when I talk about going to Africa for the first time, and I'm like, I've always wanted to go to motherland. I brought my brothers with me, and I felt like great that I could give them that experience. But the first thing I thought was, wow, like, I wish the rest of my family could see this. Mm-hmm. And because there's this break in experience. You're going on this, you know, whirlwind of travel, of experience. You're eating different food. You're living this life, especially nowadays, that looks great through a screen or on TV. And so if you live that life, there's pressure if you go to live that life kind of without the people you've grew up with, your family. There's this, I don't call it survivor's guilt, but it's a survivor's anxiety. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, oh, I made it. I have these things that I work really hard for, but I don't really have anybody that I'm comfortable with, like, wearing my nice stuff with. And so I tell a story about this watch, and like, first time I bought myself something, felt good about it, and then I got around my family and I got called out on it because of Super Bowl tickets. And it's like, you nobody's in that seat. You're the only one, right? If you're first generational wealth, you're first generational college educated, like, you are the pioneer for your family in this new direction, and they're behind you, you know. But you only see the challenges of, like, keeping it afloat of, you know, what's, you know, going in. I talk about how you could be broke with $5 million in the bank, and I had to figure out, I learned that the hard way. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, hold on, if I stop playing today, you mean all of this money is gone when I'm 35? I was like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't see that. I'm driving that ship. And I think that's an experience that we kind of all have if you're that first person in your family to really go far, the first person to have some money. You know what it took, you know, and that's why I really, one of the things we're switching is with my foundation is like this idea of financial literacy, because I watched Broke, that 30 for 30, and and that was very humbling for me, because I realized that it's not everybody's not losing money because they're starting record companies and buying jewelry. You realize there's thousands of ways to lose money. And that there's a difference between, there are two different muscles to make money and to keep money. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different, like, vehicles that are just not in our community, mm-hmm. that should be, because they're essential to, like, how we survive and thrive. Mm-hmm. And athletes are not, you know, we're not exempt from that. We were young, you know, with a bunch of money, with a lot of people, you know, dependent on you, with having to have the eyes of everybody watching. And that is an extremely isolating situation. So I kind of unveil that because I know, one, there's a lot of peers of mine who are dealing with that. That's the story of almost every athlete. But it's also the story of people, you know, who are dealing with that in their own lives. Like I said, who are blazing a new trail for their own families.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful. We're going to open it up. You can tell how much I love you because I'm University of Michigan. You are Ohio State.
I didn't even know that.
Yes, I'm told.
He kept that on the low.
Yeah, dog. Bo Schembechler forever. Forget Woody Hayes out here trying to knock people out when they're trying to run down the field. Give it up for Mr. Malcolm Jenkins right here. All right. So let's take some questions and comments.
Thank you so much for coming to Philadelphia, Nicole Ross, Hands Across Philadelphia. I wanted to hear about your mother's influence. I heard about your father's influence. And how did your mother help you stabilize and get through the situation in a male-dominated sport? We know we need balance from both sides in order to move forward with success, and I'd like to hear her input from what you've done.
That is a great question. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the lessons, I'm told y'all a lot of lessons from my dad here, because in the book you'll see my mom's influence. My mom has really been the person who's watered the vision you know, that I had. She started, you know, my philanthropy while my dad gave me the lesson or the principle of, okay, you need to take care of home. My mom plants the vision and cultivated the vision of what that looks like. And so we started in New Orleans. I was always somebody who gave back. I would do random acts of kindness, you know, go read to kids, hand out cards, you know, at the gas station, give people things, like, you know, random. And she's like, we really need to focus on your impact. It's like, do you want to be a shallow puddle that covers a large area? Do you want to plant yourself in a place and become a well, right? Mm. And so we started that in New Orleans with scholarships and like staying there. And then you realize the first thing that happens is, and she never wanted us to be like one of those organizations that comes, it's kind of like feels good, everybody, I'm an athlete, here's my charity, and then I get cut from a team, and then up that charity up and moves their resources to another place. Mm. We wanted to be a well, right? And so we were faced with those challenges, and her vision is no. We're not only are we staying in New Orleans, but we're gonna expand back to all of the places that we call home. And now, over a decade of work with the Malcolm Jenkins Foundation, with her at this head as the president, we do work in 4 different states, everywhere I've called home, Ohio, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. She's the reason that we are now instilling financial literacy programs in 4 different schools, 1 in Philly and 3 in North New Jersey. So, you know, it's one of those things, like, the house was built on her shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. 13 years old, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Enlightened mother, very enlightened mother, trust me. All right, anybody else?
So you talked about the fact that you're first generational wealth and the influence your parents had. As a father who then takes that to his children, how do you still have the same ability to instill the lessons while not giving that same level of hardship? It's a tough balance between, I can give you everything, but how do I balance the lessons and make you, you know, uplift and better people?
Yeah, one thing I got really good at as a player is taking in information that I can use and discarding what I can't. And I think that takes a little bit of discernment. And so for me, there's always things like that the generation before us experienced, and they'll try to pass that wisdom down. Some of it will apply. But these are, like, it might be different times where they're talking about, you know, things before there was an internet, right? And now there's AI. It's like, that doesn't apply anymore, you know? So it's not about trying to teach them the exact experience that I had. They're not going to have the same path. My job is to meet them where they are, really. And that's, I think, that's really at least how I'm trying to parent, is like, you know, okay, what challenges are you facing as, you know, wherever you are, and how do I help you get through that? Because trying to give you the roadmap to my experience is either obsolete or it's not going to be the same road, especially having 2 girls, right? So I'm having myself, I'm reading film on them. I'm like, okay, I got to do hair. you know, it's picture day. Like, oh, God, I don't want to look like that dad, you know. And I talk about, you know, the struggles of being a single father, like making a choice to leave my marriage and then having to shatter kind of the dream of what I thought a family would look like, but never wanting to abandon my responsibilities of being a father or compromise who I wanted to be as a father. So I had to now figure this thing out. And one of the things that, you know, thanks to my therapist, we talked about these things. It's like, well, just meet them where they are. Be there, like, be present. And you start to realize, like, okay, there's no need for me to make you, I want to teach you, you know, how to work hard, but I don't need to rob you of any kind of privilege, right? Because I've worked hard to get us these things. I need to teach you. I don't need you to go through everything I need to. I need you to just have my heart, right? Mm-hmm. Have my integrity, have my confidence. But the rest of it, you got to do it yourself. You got to be able, they have their own avatar that they got to kind of figure out. And I think the thing I like to do is empower them to figure it out for themselves. You know, I can guide you, can make you curious and do what my dad did, right? Just make you humble enough to be curious, humble enough to try to learn. but also confident enough to stand up when you need to. That'll at least get, you know, you can get on your way. You figure it out from there at least, worst case scenario.
I wanted to say thank you so much, Malcolm, for being a leader in Philadelphia for the Eagles, more so for your social and racial justice and reform. I think that it was wonderful to have you stand up for a race for Philadelphia when we all marched. It was wonderful to have your leadership. And when you showed your vulnerability after the Drew Brees comment, I feel like you really reached the masses. How did that feel, allowing yourself to really show who you are? And thank you for your grandfather for his service.
All right, amen. Thank you.
How did that feel going into back to New Orleans after having that transpire? How did that feel navigating that?
Yeah, I talk about that a lot.
See, I didn't give that away. I didn't get that away.
Yeah, I talk. It was very awkward. Mm. Like, for one, that moment, you know, the reason, one, I didn't even mean to post that video. So the vulnerability that you saw was not intended to be seen.
Can we just explain to them that Drew Brees was his quarterback at, you know, in New Orleans Saints. He was there at the beginning and then at the end, and they were very close, you know. And then Drew Brees made a comment that this social protest stuff, I don't think you should ever disrespect the flag. And then you talked to him and said, but what I'm saying to you privately, I've got to say publicly because you made your statements there. I just want to give him a little background.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm like, I decided to publicly, you know, respond. And so there's a fracture in that relationship. You know, I felt like obviously I was hurt, but it was in 2020. I was in a lot of isolation at that point in time. I also was very frustrated with what was happening politically, even within football. Not that there was a jealousy, but I almost felt like we had gotten checkmated when Roger Goodell so quickly came out and said Black Lives Matter. And then it was like, aha, there's now that's off the table, mm-hmm. right? They gave to you, they responded, because now you had newer voices, younger voices who weren't as seasoned as we were come in. So now that platform is gone and I'm sitting back and I'm looking at like, okay, how am I most effective here? My family's, you know, split. I don't know, my family had just moved, my kids just moved to New Orleans. I was in Philly, didn't know what my contract was gonna be like. And then here's a guy who, on top of that, here's a guy who I trusted, I always knew was an ally, you know, and really respected, goes back to his 2016 like talking points and just like, the flag, no. And it just broke me. I was so frustrated. And so then having to try to reconcile that was the part that I wish people actually got to see. Because I think it was something I wanted to do publicly, but that had to, you know, happen privately. When I talk about going to Drew's house that season, and then now we're both captains, and the awkward feeling like, all right, once the meeting's over, I'm trying to get out of there. I don't even want to ask him for a ride. Because it is, you know, it was tough times. But the good thing about Drew and I is that was not the end story. The only reason that it's in the book is because he and I are still friends. Mm-hmm. There's reconciliation in that. And I think there's space that we have to be able to give each other. And that's the good thing about teammates is we can have mm-hmm. those fractures, those violations in trust because we know that we're all kind of on the same team. We have the same ideas. We spend so much time together that we know we're invested. We know we're friends and we know that comes from love. So any violation wasn't meant to hurt me. And I realized that he was actually sorry. And I had to, you know, take my own time to figure out how I felt and forgive when I forgive. But I also realized too, in some accountability, that I broke his trust, you know, as a friend when he felt vulnerable, the world's crashing in on him, a voice as strong as mine, who was as close to his, you know, leaned
shut,
on him. And
I had to. What did you tell him?
I told him, shut the fuck up. Right. I told him.
You wanted them to understand that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and it only like, but I also, you know, so there's this duality of sitting in between that, right? And being a voice for the people, but also like trying to deal with personal relationships. And I think 2020 was challenging that for everybody. Mm-hmm. We're having this, you know, nationwide dialogue about race,
where Emmanuel Acho, former Eagle, has a whole show on uncomfortable conversations with a black guy. It's like, that's where we were as a country.
Right.
And so I wasn't exempt from that feeling. And I think going back to New Orleans, in that contentious space, being in lockdown, going to games with no fans, I spent a lot of time by myself. In the chapter is titled Fun, but it's actually where the game of football died for me. I stopped having fun playing the game. And I had to find new ways to revive the game. Mm. And luckily I did, and I did that through loving on my teammates, like focusing on the things that matter. It's like, what is the impact? Mm-hmm. And when we do that, when we focus on relationships, that's like what it's about. That's what makes it fun. That's playing the game. And so, that's how I navigated that, by just getting back to being or leading with love, being open, and being grateful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very powerful. The book is amazing. He talks about, you know, your friend who saved you from a gang, though you joined one later. You're a Q now.
That's a thread there.
that religion of O-Dog. But let's celebrate the athletic genius, the entrepreneurial spirit, the incredible commitment to humanity, the enormous humility, and the ability to be honest and self-giving to us. Please read the book. It's a remarkable document. Mr. Malcolm Jenkins.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.